Hi, fellow geochemists and geochemistry enthusiasts. Welcome to Geochemist Tea, the only podcast for people who love geochemistry with a side of tea. Our mission is to inspire future geochemists and to introduce our listeners to niche geochemistry topics. I'm your host, Sam Scher, and this month we are talking with Gabe Bowen about isoscapes and forensic geochemistry. Today, we're joined by Gabe Bowen, a professor of geology and geophysics at the University of Utah, where he leads the Spatiotemporal Isotope Analytics Lab and serves as director of the Surfer Stable Isotope Facility. So, Gabe, welcome to Geochemistry.
It's good to be here.
So, Gabe, can you tell our listeners about how you made your way into geochemistry and about your research?
I got started in geochemistry as an undergraduate. I didn't know what geochemistry was until I arrived at the University of Michigan. I found my way into the geological sciences program there. Shortly before my sophomore summer, I was trying to figure out what to do with my summer, and I thought I would look into opportunities for undergraduate research. Started going around knocking on doors, and one or two of the geochemists in the program were gracious enough to let me into their labs, originally wash dishes, and then built from there. My research program here at the University of Utah, we have a group that applies geochemistry in general, but specifically isotopes, especially stable isotopes, to a wide range of earth science problems. Background is in paleoclimate, so we do a lot of traditional applications where you take the isotopes, measure them in rocks, and try to unravel how the world worked millions of years in the past. Over the years, we've also shifted to a growing focus in our program on forensics and on the use of isotopes to determine the provenance of materials geographically, where they came from.
I cannot wait to dig into this. I'm a crime junkie. I love it. Who knew that we as in geochemists were so applicable to more relevant areas of life? This is just great. It gives me fodder for dinner time conversations too.
I love it. Crime scene isotopes. And it's really gratifying when the work that we're doing can have some immediate impact and relevance. And I don't know, it's one of those things. If I sit down on an airplane next to someone I don't know, we can sometimes talk paleoclimate. We can almost always talk forensics.
I try not to talk to anybody on airplanes. That's a rule.
Might be smarter.
Okay, I think that's really cool. I definitely did not have the gumption to knock on doors looking for research as an undergraduate. Something bigger in Canada was that we, instead of doing that, a lot of times we would go to a conference and try and get summer jobs working in mining camp. But that's really interesting. And I find ways that people can figure out how to get into geochemistry are helpful. So interesting.
I think we're all the sum of our experiences. And there's a lot of chance in that as opportunities come up. If you're privileged enough to have them, finding them and seeing where they take you, the thing to do.
I love it. Before then, we get into forensic geochemistry, which I cannot wait for. We start each episode with tea time, which we've talked about. This is where we invite our guests to spill some tea. What have you brought for us?
That's maybe not exactly juicy gossip. I found out earlier today, it came out in the newsletter of the Geochemical Society, that I was elected fellow of the Geochemical Society.
Ooh.
It's an honor. It's a recognition of all the awesome students and collaborators I've had the chance to work with the years. So that was pretty cool. If you're an adult beverage drinker, and if you're into isotopes, you should keep your eyes on the news over the next 12 months or so. There may be some things coming down the pike where there's some really interesting applications of isotopes. Dirt in the adult beverage industry. We'll see where it goes, but there's some interesting applications there that are emerging, I think.
And so you can't discuss it further because we got an NDA?
Oh, just...
I'm intrigued. Or should we be worried?
Yeah, there's things out there. I don't think we should be worried, but it's an intriguing application of isotopes. So there's stuff out there already in the press, various different things that are working their way through the system. But yeah, I think it'll be an interesting thing for us geochemists to talk about at the bar.
Because we already have a geochemist friend of mine who is down in Chile. He's really big into geochemistry of wine.
Yeah.
This will be a little bit different though. All right. Hold strong for that.
Okay.
Like I mentioned earlier, before we get into the main Q&A, I think it's important for everybody to know that I'm definitely a crime junkie. I love listening to true crime. watching it, not as much. I find that these documentaries could get really long-winded. That's a personal thought. That said, I am intrigued by anything related to forensic science investigations, the idea that geochem can help solve some real-world problems and mysteries. Definitely immediately hooked, and I hope that everybody else can continue on this journey with us, particularly since a lot of your work sits at the intersection of these two fields. So for this, I'd really just love to dig into how geochemistry is being used to trace where people and sometimes even objects come from. Starting with the basics, could you explain what forensic isotope geochemistry is and what kinds of problems it's going to help solve?
Really, what we're talking about here is using isotopes, translating what we know from a lot of the classical studies in geochemistry, anthropology, and moving them into more of an applied space. Isotopes have always been clues about unraveling mysteries. The cool thing about isotopes is they're in everything, and they tell us about the origin of the materials. And what we have to do as isotope geochemists is, A, make a good measurement, but then B, a big part of it is figuring out how to unlock that evidence, figuring out how to interpret and what it means, what we can learn from it. So really, when we talk about isotope forensics, there's a bunch of different flavors, but we're ultimately talking about unraveling the story of some material that we've sampled. Its history, and that might be a geographic origin, it might be the history in terms of the processes that were used to produce it, might be the history in terms of the diet of an individual or some other aspect of the environment that they were living in that affected them. But it all really comes down to measuring those clues and then interpreting them.
I think my default is always carbon-14. Is this on a scale of something more recent, something very recent, like a murder that might have happened 5 days ago, or is it looking at kind of anthropological timelines?
It can really be any of the above.
Interesting.
Yeah, you mentioned carbon-14. Carbon-14 has actually been used for this kind of work. It's useful for determining the age of materials. And in most forensics contexts, that's been focused on the post-bomb radiocarbon era.
Okay.
Started above ground testing of nuclear weapons, throwing the natural cycle of carbon-14 into a spin. We have this beautiful signal we've put into the atmosphere, essentially doubling the amount of carbon-14 in the atmosphere starting in the 1950s. Once we stopped that above ground weapons testing, the pulse of radiocarbon started to dissipate, go away, and mostly be mixed into the ocean. The upshot of this is you can measure radiocarbon in tooth enamel, bones, tusks, wine, what have you. And if it's a sample from the post-bomb era, you can often tell within about an uncertainty of about a year when that sample originated, how old that person was, or when the wine was grown and put in the bottle. More generally, a lot of the work that we're doing is focused on very recent, very modern situations, persons and unidentified individuals in various different contexts. Sometimes that's remains that are recovered from a fairly recent death or disappearance. We're also working with groups in the Department of Defense in the U.S. to identify the remains of service members lost in World War II and the Vietnam War and Korea.
It just blows my mind. Garden Police Agency know about something like this, or who's in the know about this?
We're still early in the translation of these techniques to your average police agency. You mentioned you don't love the crime dramas on TV. Isotopes have shown up in them a few times already. I wouldn't say the coverage has been particularly accurate or good, but they do show up. So that builds awareness. We've worked with various different law enforcement groups throughout the country to isotopes, particularly to cold cases. Usually that's through a coroner's office or some program within a state that is specifically focused on trying to clear cold cases, trying to resolve those cases, and maybe more cued into cutting edge forensic science techniques. A lot of times they've heard about isotopes, they might get in touch and ask whether it could be used to help resolve some of the cases they're working on.
I have 1,000 questions, but let's try and keep the flow. Here we go. Also read a few papers for this, which we'll post in the show notes, but a lot of this work revolves around this term called isoscapes. So could you talk us through what exactly is an isoscape and why these spatial isotope maps can be so powerful in these forensic investigations?
To lead into isoscapes, let's first start with one of the fundamental principles that underlies most of these provenance applications, and that is you are what you eat isotopically. So whatever you take into your body, if it's drinking water, if it's food, that imparts an isotopic signal to your body, your signature to your body, and that's translated into the tissues that you grow. And so isoscapes are really ultimately about how we interpret that information, because what we need to do if we have a piece of forensic evidence, a hair sample from a crime scene or something like that, we need to be able to measure the isotope composition of that material, but then also compare it with something. We need a context for interpreting the values that we generate. We need reference information. We need to know what those isotopes would look like if the person was living in point A or traveling between points B and C. And that's really what isoscapes are about. So this really is no different from how we would work with DNA evidence. DNA sample from an individual itself is useless unless we have something to compare it with. One way we might approach that is we could collect reference samples from people that we think might be related to an individual or potential identities of individuals who might have been the origin of that sample. We could do the same thing with isotopes. We can take our sample of hair from the crime scene and measure the isotopes. And then if we have a few ideas in mind about where that person could have been, we can go to those locations and collect reference samples that tell us what isotopes look like in those locations. But that's limiting because it means that each case, each new piece of evidence, we need ideas about where that person might have been traveling or come from or lived in the past. And then we need to go sample them. That's challenging. We need to make measurements. We need to figure out what type of reference samples we might need from those locations. And so isoscapes is a concept that we developed to try to generalize these applications. Ultimately, it boils down to the fact that isotope distributions, the isotope values that we see in the environment and in animals and people, different places on the planet, the variation is systematic. There are fundamental chemical and physical processes in the environment that give rise to distributions of isotopes that are systematic across landscapes. And that is an isoscape. So an isoscape is essentially a quantitative model that's based on data, theory, some combination thereof, that allows us to predict what isotope values we would expect to see different places in time on the planet. And so now instead of needing to take our forensic sample, our casework sample, and go out and compare it with a database we've built, we now have a map, right? An isoscape model and map. And we can take that sample from our new casework, we can compare it with the map, and we can say, these are all the various locations that are good matches to that sample from that casework.
I'm trying to process this. So I'm just thinking about, let's say, me, like the last month, I've been to three different places, three different countries. I've eaten two very similar and then one vastly different type of food. How would you use that information? And let's say that I was murdered in one of those places. How would you use this information?
Yeah, in this unfortunate situation.
Which is not going to happen. But in this, yes.
If an investigator brought us a sample, for example, of your hair, right? Mm-hmm. And asked us questions about the history of this individual. Are they likely to be a resident? If they are a local resident, have they traveled elsewhere in the last 6 months? What we could do then is we could take that hair sample. Hair is a wonderful tissue to use for this because it grows progressively over time and it's constantly recording isotopic information about where you are at any given point in time as that new hair grows. So we could take that sample, we could chop it up into segments, we could measure the isotope ratios, and then each of those segments represents a different point in time, and we can compare it with our isoscape maps for human hair. And if we're interested in the first question that we were given, is this person likely to be a local resident, we might look across that length of hair to see all those different segments that we've measured to see, do the values tend to match what we expect at the location where you met your unfortunate demise? And if all of the samples match the local expectations for the local location, or if We see that the values vary, but they keep coming back to values that are consistent with what we expect at that location, then we might answer, yes, it's likely this person was a local resident.
This is helping with the Jane or the John Doe problem.
Exactly. So it's an investigative tool. It hasn't been used much as evidence in the courtroom, but it's definitely been useful as an investigative tool because
for sure,
these questions about life history can help guide an investigation, help an investigator decide what to go after next, right? What to pursue.
I'm seeing the vision now. This is interesting. We're recording information all the time in, say, our hair. Which isotope systems do you find to be most informative in these types of studies? Could you walk us through why oxygen, hydrogen, strontium are commonly used to investigate geographic origin as well, or if there's other systematics that you're using?
There's a lot to be learned here still, but there are certain isotope systems that have attracted broad attention. Ultimately, the reason comes down to what they tell us about an individual's history. So if the goal is ultimately to build a life history or understand some aspect of that person's history, we want to be looking at the isotope systems that give us useful pieces of information. So you mentioned oxygen and hydrogen. Let's start with those. Oxygen and hydrogen in our bodies comes dominantly from the water that we drink. So you just took a sip of Diet Coke or something like that.
I did.
The water in that Diet Coke is coming from the bottling plant that's probably not too far away from where you're living right now. It carries an isotopic signature, an isotopic composition that's related to or derived from the local groundwater, the local surface water. And so for hydrogen and oxygen, the ultimate source of the signal and the variation geographically comes from the water cycle. We don't have to go into all the details. We can if you really want, but
this is a safe space for rabbit holes. So all right, bring all right. us down the rabbit holes. This is what we're here for.
Right. Let's go back to the 60s. One of the first things
that
we figured out in isotope geochemistry, we figured out that water cycling in the atmosphere, the process of evaporating water into the atmosphere, and then winds transporting it around, and then rainstorms and snowstorms happening, involves a lot of sorting of hydrogen and oxygen isotopes. And the further away from the source you get, the less of the heavy isotopes you have. Heavy isotopes are always more sluggish. They're harder to move around. They tend to fall out of the atmosphere first. And as you take water from the oceans, evaporate it, move it across the continent, every time it rains, you're losing more and more of the heavy isotopes relative to the light isotopes. So that gives rise to these continental scale and global scale patterns in hydrogen and oxygen isotopes in waters, fresh waters on the continent.
Interesting.
The closer to the equator you are, the closer to the coast you are, the lower elevation you are, the more of the heavy isotopes you have.
I'm going to have the heavy ones.
Where are you right now?
I live in Washington, D.C.
Oh, Washington, D.C. Okay, you're probably drinking waters maybe -5 per mil or something like that, which here in Utah, we're -14. So those are the kinds of differences we're dealing with. And that signal that ultimately comes out of the atmosphere is translated through the hydrologic cycle all the way to drinking water. So over the years,
we could probably market this liquid death like next level. We could probably do something with this.
Oh, it's
convince people.
It's been done.
It's better if it's lighter.
Yeah, it's been done. There are brands that have marketed isotopically light water as healthy for. I won't go too far into that, but let's just suffice to say that the level of variation we're talking about here is so tiny that the body can't really sense it. Everything just moves through. But it leaves these imprints in the isotope ratios, which we can measure with our mass spectrometers. So that's what's going on with oxygen and hydrogen. That signal from the atmosphere is then translated into surface waters, groundwaters, all the way to drinking waters, and then to people. And the upshot of that is that there are these kind of strong gradients across continents that I described. So oxygen and hydrogen is good for giving us a big picture look at where a person might have been or traveled. Large parts of North America, for example, have very similar oxygen and hydrogen isotope values. And this person who lived in Washington, D.C. would look isotopically a lot like somebody who lived in northern Alabama. We couldn't tell them apart, but we could clearly distinguish them from someone in Michigan or Colorado.
Okay.
And there's these big gradients, right? So that's a pattern that's useful. Strontium is fundamentally different. It ends up in a lot of the same body parts that we have oxygen and hydrogen and almost everything, but we can find strontium in the body as well. It's fundamentally different because it comes from rocks. The source of strontium in the environment and our food and our drinking water is ultimately from the bedrock sediment that we're living on. Weathers out of that, goes into aquifers, streams, watersheds, and finds its way into us. And as a result, the pattern of variation in strontium isotopes looks like a geologic map.
I love this. Keep with this thread.
It's patchy. It's not. Oxygen and hydrogen are strongly related to climate. Strontium's not. It doesn't care what the climate is. It just depends on what's underneath us. It's the age of that rock and the type of rock. So if we put the two together, oxygen gives us this big picture look, or hydrogen, this big picture look across these gradients on the continent, cold places, warm places. And then within any of those regions, strontium will have this patchy distribution where it'll allow us to hone in on sub-regions within the area that oxygen or hydrogen's identified. So the two in combination can be really powerful. If they're not going to yield a unique location in all cases or in many cases, but they're going to help us shrink that radius and come up with a more specific answer.
One thing that I'm thinking of right now, I'm going to describe this for our listenership. If anybody was to go to Massachusetts, they're very big in making cranberries up there, which grow in bogs, which is very swampy, lots of clay. Washington, D.C. is also a swamp, and not just metaphorically. It is a true swamp, lots of clay. So both are coastal. So I would have these heavier isotopes for oxygen, hydrogen, but also would my strontium look fairly similar to somebody that's from one of these boggy, swampy areas in Massachusetts?
But it'll come down to the origin of those clays.
Interesting.
Okay. What rocks they're coming out of, how old the rocks are. And in both locations, you may actually have a confounding factor, proximity to the ocean. So if you're close enough to the ocean that some of that sea spray and other things, that's detectable. That we can also resolve with another isotope system, sulfur.
Ooh, so you can silver.
Sulfur.
Oh, I thought you said silver. Wait, what? Did you?
I haven't gotten into silver yet, but sulfur is also proven to be very useful in identifying consumption. So it's more of a dietary isotope. There's a certain suite of isotopes that we get mainly from things that we eat. Carbon, sulfur is another. Sulfur has been shown to be, if you eat a whole lot of marine fish, seafood, that'll show up in your sulfur. So we can see that in Western Europe. There's certain areas of coastal France where people's sulfur is pretty different. But it also shows up in soils and ecosystems and people who live in coastal regions.
Okay, guys, I promise this is the last one I'm going to throw out here. I'm originally from Long Island in New York, which is glacial moraine till. Geographically very different from coastal Quebec.
Yeah.
But could have very similar rocks, potentially.
So you've hit on one of the big challenges that we encountered when we started to try to make isoscapes of strontium for strontium, which is that geology is challenging. We don't always have all the information that we want in certain places in the Midwestern United States or New York, where the shallow geology is dominated by tills and moraines and material that might have actually been moved hundreds of kilometers by glaciers. The isotopes coming out of that stuff as it weathers are really hard to predict because we don't have enough information.
This has been great. Thank you for this rabbit hole. To summarize, we got hydrogen, oxygen, strontium, and sulfur at the minimum. And we're just doing the best we can to try and pinpoint where the body that you have is from. I find that amazing. Okay, we can move on to the next question. I can't get over. This is fascinating. I know that what people do in life, they probably find interesting, but maybe it's not so often that other people are like, oh my gosh, tell me more.
I love talking about it.
So when we're analyzing human tissues for isotopes, different tissues are going to record different environmental signals over different timescales. So how do tissues like hair, teeth, and bone differ in the kind of information that they preserve?
We talked, so tape recorder, and it's only going to give us the recent history. For you, you've got maybe a year and a half on your head, something like that. I've got something similar. I don't know, you've just joined the Marines, you're likely to have a month or so recorded on your scalp. The nice thing about hair is it's continuously locking in information about what's happened to you recently. If recent travel, for example, is of interest, that's a great option. Fingernails, toenails are similar, right? It's the same material biochemically, just grows a bit slower. There's been interesting work done on nails as well. You can do the same thing. You can chop it up and get a time series. Teeth are another one that's proven to be really useful. And teeth are useful almost for the opposite reason. Tooth enamel forms during your childhood, adult teeth. Depending on the tooth, it can form anywhere from starting when you're in utero. Some of our adult teeth start to mineralize before birth. Up to wisdom teeth, which are the last ones to form and mineralize between maybe 7 and 15 years of age. But the cool thing about teeth is once it forms, once it's fully formed, that enamel doesn't change, right? The isotopic composition's locked in. With teeth, we can take a tooth and say with a good deal of certainty what period of life that represents. It's sometime during childhood. We can identify the tooth. We can say when during childhood. But it locks in that information about early life history. If that's useful, if we have maybe a potential identity for an individual and we know something about where they grew up, we can go to those teeth and say, it's a match, it's not a match, it's ambiguous. So what we can start to do with multiple tissues is build something of a residential life history. This person maybe lived recently, or at least the isotopes are consistent with them, living recently in the same place that they were born and grew up. Or we might be dealing with relocation situations, if people are suspected refugees or border crossers. And in that case, you might do a comparison to check and see if it's consistent with somebody who's moved long distances or relocated between their early life and more recent life. There are a variety of other tissues which are potentially useful, but a little trickier to work with. Bone's been used a lot in archaeology. Archaeologists are always working with bones. They always have bones on hand. The challenge with bones is it's this uncomfortable intermediate between teeth and hair. Unlike teeth is constantly turning over, it's constantly being rebuilt. And so that process resets the isotopes and we start over time to lose information on where that person was a long time ago, add in information on where they've been recently. And that process is not super well understood. So there's a lot of variation between different types of bones, and there's a lot of ambiguity about what period of time is integrated and reflected in the signals.
I'm just trying to think of something. If you broke your bone, would you see, in that fracture, would you then see some additional newer information?
Yeah, that's a really interesting idea. I don't know if it's been studied with isotopes. Can't think of it off the top of my head. I would assume that yes, that repair of that bone is going to involve your osteoblasts working overtime to build new tissue and repair that fracture. And that ultimately is going to be material that reflects your recent current location and conditions of life. That might be a situation where you could, if you have a very recently healed fracture, you might be able to go and measure that and you'd get a different period of integration than the bulk bone itself. There's a lot of details, a lot of nuances here. Ultimately, it comes down to understanding that it's not any different than isotopes in a rock, right? You have to understand the origin of that phase that you're looking at and how it was formed in order to understand the story it's telling.
Thinking, maybe going back a little bit, I think when we're looking at these things, we want all these things to be not necessarily facts, but like black or white. But a lot of what we've been talking about is that it can't pinpoint exact locations, but rather we're talking about things in terms of probabilities. So in terms of either us on this end thinking about it when we see it now coming up in all of our true crime stuff, or more importantly, investigators, how should we think about these in terms of the uncertainty and probably also making people more comfortable in that uncertainty as well?
It's the reality of the information. That there's no single place on Earth that has a completely unique combination of isotopes that we could pinpoint with 100% certainty based on a set of measurements we made on a forensic sample. What we get is information on consistency. This looks a lot like that. It's very consistent with the values you'd expect at that location or not. We're dealing with probabilities. It's ultimately probabilistic information, which I'll point out is what we're dealing with DNA evidence too. Right? We have some probability that a reference sample is a match to our casework sample. In the case of DNA, we have millions of base pairs to look at, a huge number of base pairs to look at. And so we have a whole lot of independent pieces of information that together create much more unique distributions. And so in that case, our probabilities can be really low or really high. And we tend to then talk about that as being a match or not a match with certainty. But it's really in principle the same thing that we're dealing with at isotopes. With the isotopes, we're dealing with many fewer pieces of information. If we can combine strontium isotopes and oxygen isotopes and maybe also lead isotopes, then we have three independent pieces of information. It's only three. So it's not going to give us a unique location, but the more pieces of evidence we can put together, the more specific we can get, right? The more we can say in which locations this person could have been at, or we can exclude, which is often more useful. Say, yeah, this is really not likely that this person lived here or here.
As we've been talking about, these continental escapes require enormous data sets. What kind of environmental measures and other modeling inputs and approaches will go into constructing these styles of maps?
We've been working on over the last 20 years or so, and a lot has changed. One of the things that's made IceScape work possible is a change in the scientific culture in geochemistry and earth science toward more open science, more sharing of data. Going back to my first work on IceScapes, lucky to be working with oxygen hydrogen isotopes in water and rainwater in particular, which at that time had been measured extensively at many sites by a global community. That data had been put together, compiled, and shared. And so I was able to work with that data set, which at the time was a few tens of thousands of measurements of isotope composition of water across the globe. Since that time, we now have databases that contain hundreds of thousands of isotope measurements of water. Through the efforts of colleagues and collaborators, there are now databases of strontium isotopes in various environmental materials that include many tens of thousands of samples. That's the amount of information, the level of data that we need to start to build models and have confidence in the isotope patterns that we're predicting. A lot of times what we end up doing in these studies is measuring environmental samples as a surrogate forensic materials we're actually interested in. It's a lot harder to get people to give you their teeth than it is to go out and collect water samples, drinking water samples. So,
yeah, I want to hold on to mine.
Yeah. We just got through a project where we got 750 people from the US to give us wisdom teeth that have been extracted so we can measure those directly.
Had I known, I could have.
A lot of times what we do is we end up taking a hybrid approach. We can measure a lot of environmental samples, drinking water, food, soil. The key in selecting the environmental samples is trying to find a material that is representative of what people take into their bodies. There's a fair amount of research on this. For example, for strontium isotopes, a lot of focus has been put on, a lot of study has been done primarily by the archaeologists. Is it better to measure soil or plants growing on that soil or small rodents eating the plants and seeds from that environment? All of these things have been looked at, and it turns out if you just measure the soil, you're not seeing the full picture because not all the minerals in the soil contribute strontium in the same way. It tends to be better to measure biological materials from that local environment. Hydrogen and oxygen, water is a very good indicator. We know a lot about isotopes and precipitation, hydrogen and oxygen isotopes and precipitation, but historically we've known less about what actually ends up in drinking water. And there's a couple of steps between there. We've done a lot of work to study those relationships, what happens to the isotopes as you go from rainwater, through different water resources and then ultimately into what people consume. We look at those environmental sample databases and we'll come in with enough samples of the material that we're actually going to be using in forensic casework, hair, teeth, whatever, to characterize the relationships between the environment and the human tissues or other materials we're working with in the casework.
Do you see that as these data sets continue to grow, do you think that it's going to be more widely adopted into investigative work? And what are the barriers to entry, the big hurdles?
It's a lot of work to develop the databases and underpinnings of the applications. So that's been the biggest hurdle. Each new system that we want to go into, each new type of evidence we want to work with, there's research that needs to be done and maybe databases that need to be built. And that takes time and it's expensive. So, you know, that's one thing that has slowed us down. We're getting to the point where there are common types of evidentiary materials like hair, teeth, that we know enough about that we now don't have to go through this process of building an application from the ground up. We can start applying it real world. New things come up. We have a lot of interest recently in textiles and isotopes and figuring out where textiles have come from or using isotopes to help with that. That's a new type of material. It requires new research, new databases. It takes time for us to build out that new application. One thing that's helping here is our modeling approaches. A lot of the isoscape development work is now being done using machine learning, for example, which can wring more out of the data sets that we have and also accelerate and make it quicker to move from database development to interpretation tools, isoscapes and tools for interpretation. The other thing that I think is going to have an impact here is improvements in measurement technologies. Unfortunately, making these isotope measurements still takes extensive sample preparation, almost always expensive, finicky machinery in a specialized laboratory. It's not the CSI Miami scenario where they get a piece of evidence one evening and the next morning that person lived in Ukraine 3 months ago, right?
With a nice fancy screen, please.
It takes, depending on what we're measuring, between a week and a month to get a set of isotope measurements. And sometimes it's acceptable. If it's a cold case that's been cold for 2 decades, maybe that's not a big deal. But if you're working in real time and you need an answer quickly, that's a barrier to using these methods. Geochemistry as a field, to a large degree, been driven by innovations in analytical technologies that open up new possibilities. And that's continuing to happen with stable isotopes. We have new types of instruments that have come on the market and been adopted since I started in this field the last 25 years or so. Those are making new types of measurements possible. They're making measurements cheaper, quicker. So I think as that continues to happen, that'll be really advantageous for the uptake of these approaches.
I guess my last question is, what are some of the pitfalls in interpreting these isotopic signals that are distinctly human from other signals? Because inherently these complex biological systems, whether we're just one singular human or all the other things that happen a day in the life on Earth.
There's a lot that could be said there, a lot that goes into that. It's about complexities associated with people. And humans are complicated. We do a lot of weird things to our environment. We have complicated behavior. That can complicate interpretation of the isotopes a bit. One example is people often ask me about bottled water, right? What if I drink bottled water? Does that change the isotopes in my body, in my hair, my teeth? And the answer is that it could if you are the rare person that only drinks and cooks with Evian, which is a single source bottled water, comes from the mountains in France. If that's all you ever consumed, then you would look a lot like someone who lived in that part of France.
You're talking with a French accent.
That might be a giveaway right there.
Yeah.
It turns out that it's really expensive to ship water from France. And so most of the bottled water that we consume, as well as the carbonated beverages and whatever, most of it is produced pretty locally. It tends to be water from your local environment that's run through a filter, put in a plastic bottle and sold at a 20 times markup. We published a paper in 2005, I think, a global survey of bottled waters, their isotope values, and it turns out that 97% of them are indistinguishable from local tap water.
I believe that.
The key thing is knowing which ones are likely to matter, likely to make a difference, and making sure that you're accounting for that in your uncertainty. But you compare the casework data, the evidentiary material with the isoscapes or the reference samples, and then you're not being overconfident given all of the possibilities that are inherent.
I love it. This is fascinating. However, one thing that I want to do before we wrap all this up is that, so for all of our listeners, when Gabe first gave me a few papers to choose from, he gave me three distinct topics, all of which I wanted to talk about Great Salt Lake, maybe next time. But there was another piece of your research that you do in collaboration with others that I think is related to what we're talking. I mean, tusks, bones, teeth, we're talking about the same family of things, especially when we talk about movement of things. So before we wrap up, I wanted to pivot to a different part of your research. A lot of people may not realize that isotope geochem also gets used to study animal movement in ecology, including elephants and fish. So could you tell us how this ended up becoming part of your isotope research?
Yeah, the applications to animals go back really almost as far as the application to our species of humans. Mm. And really all the same principles apply. Yeah, we're talking about a very similar thing. We might be dealing with a different body tissue. That organism might have different behavior and physiology, but again, they are what they eat and what they drink related to the environment that they're living in. So you can take isotopes measured in the teeth or tusks of elephants, and my colleague Terry Serling here at the university has for decades used that as a tool to study the ecology of African elephants, but also as a forensic tool to look at seized ivory and help understand its origins. Mm-hmm. You can take the ear stones of fish, the otoliths, they look like a tiny tree when you suction it.
Interesting.
And you can measure the isotopes in those rings and infer pathways of movement of that fish within its aquatic habitat. So we can apply that to fisheries research or ecological research in aquatic ecosystems. It's all part and parcel.
Geochems are just so useful to the world. They just don't know it yet. So finally, just to wrap everything up, what are some of the most surprising or memorable things that you've learned when working with these animal isotope records?
I have a grad student right now who's doing a lot of work on salmon fisheries in the Pacific Northwest, using mainly strontium isotopes and these ear stones. We're looking at the movements of these individuals through their habitats. And salmon breed, they're hatched in streams, freshwater streams, rivers, and then they spend most of their life out in the marine environment before they come back to the rivers to spawn. And the general understanding is that there's a lot of site fidelity, so that a salmon will tend to try to go back to the location where it was born. Studying a transboundary watershed in Alaska and Canada up there, the student Kyle had a paper out a couple of years ago where he was using this tool. And one of the neatest things that showed up is that it was a very small fraction of this river basin, this catchment. Less than 10% of the area within this watershed turned out to be really important spots for these salmon fisheries and for recruitment of these fish. You know, it was not a single spot. It was distributed throughout, but there were certain habitats throughout this which were hot spots for production. When you think about trying to protect these fisheries, trying to restore habitat, that's the kind of information that you need to make these decisions. You need to know, not that we want to give up 90% of the watershed and allow it just to go to waste, but we want to be certain that if things are happening, if there's a mining project in that watershed, for example, that we understand how the affected parts of the watershed, of the stream system, which ones are most likely to be important for that fishery, which ones are likely to have the biggest impact, and might we want to focus on most intensively as we're trying to protect habitat or do environmental remediation. So that was pretty cool.
That's pretty cool. Similar but different story about that. There's a project in Alaska that will never go forward because nobody that has any financial sense cannot bankroll this, but basically the finding of it was that it's this beautiful porphyry system, acidic, naturally polluted. We'll just say the EPA, I'm sorry to throw them under the bus, was that the water, the stream had to be remediated to neutral, but the stream is naturally polluted and it had to be remediated to neutral in perpetuity. So to remediate it actually isn't helping anything because they're naturally, anyway, it was this whole thing. It was very fascinating.
Cool. Problem in conservation. What is the state we're trying to conserve and why?
Yeah.
If you don't know that, it's really tough. You can do some stupid things.
Anyway, I want to thank you for joining me today and for sharing your insights into this world of forensic isotope geochemistry. I think it's fascinating to see how some of the same geochemical tools that I've been using and others have been using to study Earth systems can now be used to answer questions about movement, provenance, environmental history, whether it's in human investigations and understanding the lives of animals. To everybody else, if you've enjoyed listening to this episode of Geochemistry, please consider sharing it with a colleague or a fellow geochemist who might find this conversation interesting. I know of a few that I will be sharing who are not even geochemists that I think will find this interesting. Crime junkies. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you next time for another conversation about science, mentorship, and stories shaping the geochemistry community. I want to thank our sponsor, LKI Consulting, and to It's Water and Coma Media for our music, and I'm looking forward to chatting with everybody next month.
Thanks, it's been a treat.